Solicitor General, the government's motion to conduct part of the oral arguments involving security matters in camera, as has been done in the district courts in New York and Washington and in the courts of appeal in the Second Circuit and the District of Columbia Circuit, is denied by the court. Mr. Justice Harlan, Mr. Justice Blackmun, and I would grant a limited in-camera argument, as has been done in all the hearings in these cases until now. Under the order granting the writ yesterday, counsel may, if they wish, submit arguments in writing under seal in lieu of the in-camera oral argument. Mr. Solicitor General, you may proceed.
Mr. Chief Justice, may I say, in respect of the announcement just made, that all three parties have filed a closed brief as well as the open brief, and in addition, I have filed just within minutes two statements, one prepared by the State Department and one prepared by the Department of Defense, giving more detail about some of the items which are discussed in my closed brief, and I believe that those will all be before the court.
Are you suggesting that these matters last filed are security matters, or they merely supplement and explain?
The only ones that are security matters that I have filed are all marked top secret.
Thank you very much. Just wanted to be sure as to these last documents.
The items filed by the Post and the Times, I do not believe, are marked top secret, but they are marked in camera in the caption of the items. I repeat, all three have also filed regular briefs, except not printed. Only the American Civil Liberties Union seemed to have the resources to produce a printed brief for this occasion. I am told that the law students of today are indignantly opposed to final examinations because they say that no lawyer ever has to work under such pressure that he has to get things out in 3 or 4 hours. I can only say that I think it's perhaps fortunate that Mr. Glendon and Mr. Bickle and I went to law school under an earlier dispensation. It is important, I think, to get this case in perspective. The case, of course, raises important and difficult problems about the constitutional right of free speech and of the free press. And we've heard much about that from the press in the last 2 weeks. But it also raises important questions of the equally fundamental and important right of the government to function. Great emphasis has been put on the First Amendment, and rightly so. But there is also involved here a fundamental question of separation of powers in the sense of the power and authority which the Constitution allocates to the President as Chief Executive and as Commander-in-Chief of the Army and Navy. And involved in that, there is also the question of the integrity of the institution of the presidency. Whether that institution, one of the three great powers under the separation of powers, can function effectively. The problem lies on a wide spectrum, and like all questions of constitutional law, involves the resolution of competing principles. In the first place, it seems to me that it will be helpful to make some preliminary observations. If we start out with the assumption that never under any circumstances can the press be subjected to prior restraint, never under any circumstances can the press be enjoined from publication, of course we come out with the conclusion that there can be no injunction here. But I suggest, not as necessarily conclusive in this case, but I suggest that there is no such constitutional rule and never has been such a constitutional rule. We have, for example, the copyright laws. And my son was in Toronto earlier this week and he sent me copies of the Globe and Mail of Toronto, 10 series, the story the Pentagon is trying to kill, each one headed copyright New York Times service. I have no objection to that, but these stories, which have been published, have been copyrighted by the New York Times and I believe by the Washington Post, and I have no doubt that perhaps in other cases, because these have already attracted much attention, the New York Times and the Washington Post would seek to enforce their copyright. I suppose it is very likely that in one form or another, they have obtained royalties because of their copyright on this matter. But let us also consider other fields of the law. There is a well-known branch of the law that goes under the heading of literary property. In the Court of Appeals, I gave the example of a manuscript written by Ernest Hemingway, let's assume while he's still living, unpublished, perhaps incomplete, subject to revision. In some way, the press gets hold of it. Perhaps it's stolen. Perhaps it's bought from a secretary through breach of fiduciary responsibility. Or perhaps it's found on the sidewalk. And if the New York Times sought to print that, I have no doubt that Mr. Hemingway, or now his heirs, next of kin, could obtain from the courts an injunction against the press printing. Only this morning I see in the paper that a New York publisher is bringing a suit against Newsday, a New York newspaper, because Newsday has violated what the New York publisher considers to be its copyright in the forthcoming memoirs of President Johnson. And then, finally, or not finally, but next, we have a whole series of law, a traditional branch of equity, involving participation in a breach of trust. And there cannot be the slightest doubt, it seems to me, that no matter what the motive, no matter what the justification, that both the New York Times and the Washington Post are here consciously, intentionally participating in a breach of trust. They know that this material is not theirs. They do not own it. I'm not talking about the pieces of paper which they may have acquired. I'm talking about the literary property, the concatenation of words, which is protected by the law of literary property. And again, I say, I don't regard this as controlling or conclusive in this case. I'm simply trying to advance the proposition that there are many factors and many facets here, and that there is no constitutional rule that there can never be prior restraint on the press or on free speech. Now, in our main brief in this case, we have, which I may say was largely prepared by my associate, Mr. Friedman, last evening and last night. We have cited one case which comes very close to being an injunction by this court against publications in the press, and that is the Associated Press case in, I believe, 215 United States. The Associated Press is a cooperative of newspapers, and there the Associated Press sought and obtained an injunction against the dissemination of news by its competitor, United, or International Press in that case, not United, by its competitor, International. And that was granted on copyright and related grounds. But we have other areas in the law where this court has approved against specific First Amendment claims injunctions in advance forbidding speech. One area of this is the labor law field, where as recently as 395 U.S. in Sinclair against the National Labor Relations Board, the court unanimously affirmed the judgment of the Court of Appeals enforcing the board's order, which included a provision requiring Sinclair to cease and desist from threatening the employees with the possible closing of the plant or the transfer of the weaving production with the attendant loss of employment or with any other economic reprisals if they were to select the above named or any other labor organization. In 393 U.S., case involving the Federal Trade Commission, Federal Trade Commission against the against Texaco Inc., involving orders with respect to TBA, tires, battery, and accessories. The court approved the order of the Federal Trade Commission, which restrained Texaco from using or attempting to use any device such as, but not limited to, dealer discussions. They were ordered not to speak to dealers about this subject, and the First Amendment was specifically referred to in the brief for the respondent and was not mentioned in this court's opinion.
Mr. Solicitor General, of course, there's the Times film case as well, and there are no doubt others. I didn't understand, however, that your brother counsel on the other side really questioned any of this. I thought that at least for purposes of this case, they conceded that an injunction would be not violative of the First Amendment, or put it this way, that despite the First Amendment, an injunction would be permissible in this case if the disclosure of this material would, in fact, pose a grave and immediate danger to the security of the United States. That is, that for purposes of this case, they've conceded that, but they have said that, in fact, the disclosure of this material would not pose any such grave immediate danger.
Mr. Justice, if they have conceded it, I am glad to proceed on that basis.
No, I'm not conceding it for them, but that had been my understanding of what the issue is. They'll make it clear, of course, to us.
I may say that their briefs were served on me within the last 15 minutes, which are our last hour, which was entirely in accordance with this court's order, but I have not seen their briefs. I do not know what is in their briefs.
In other words, I had thought in my analysis, and I haven't had the benefit of much more time than you've had, that this basically came down to a fact case, that the issues here are factual issues.
And that, Mr. Justice, is extremely difficult to discuss
in
open court. And we have endeavored to...
I was going to say, qualifying that, except as to the scope of judicial review of the executive determination, which I And as to what standard it is, Mr. Solicitor General.
Mr. Justice White, it was the latter point for which I was seeking to get this, because our contention, particularly with respect to the Washington Post case, is that the wrong standard has been used. Now, with respect to the actual factual situations, the only thing that I can do is to point to the closed brief which I have filed, in which there are 10 specific items referred to. Now, when I say specific items, I must make myself very clear. Some of those are collective. I have brought here, you perhaps can't see them, the 47 volumes that are supposed to be the background of this. They are included in the record of the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which has been filed with the court. Let me say, when we move on to this next item, that it was inevitable that I delegate the question of preparing the supplemental statement, which was covered by this court's order yesterday. This court, as did the Second Circuit, referred to the material specified in the special appendix in the Second Circuit and to such additional items as might be included on a supplemental statement filed at 5 p.m. yesterday. I had nothing to do with preparing that supplemental statement. I had able and conscientious associates who did work on it. However, when I had a chance to see it last evening, particularly after the State Department called me at 8 or 9 o'clock at night and said they had 4 additional items, and I said that the court's deadline was 5 p.m. and that I could not add any additional items, I then examined it. Here is a copy, and I find it much too broad. In particular, it has at the end a statement, in view of the uncertainties as to the precise documents in defendant's custody, and I say that has been an extreme difficulty in this matter. We don't know now, never have known, what the papers have.
I thought the New York Times was required to and did give you a list of what it is.
They prepared an inventory, but from it, it is not possible to tell whether they are the same papers that we have. Part of the problem here is that a great mass of this material is not included in the 47 volumes. It is background material, earlier drafts of some papers which are materially different from what is included in the 47 volumes. And as a result, we cannot tell from the inventory what is included. For example, one of the items already published, which has caused a certain amount of controversy publicly and internationally, is a telegram to the Canadian government that is not in the 47 volumes and is not referred to in the 47 volumes. Where they got it, how they got it, what it is, I do not know. But in this supplemental memorandum, it is stated under my signature that the petitioner specifies, in addition to the foregoing, any information relating to the following. And then there are listed 13 items. And frankly, I regard that as much too broad. And therefore, I am saying here that we rely, with respect to this factual question, only on the items specified in the supplemental appendix filed in the Second Circuit, and on such additional items as are covered in my closed brief in this case.
Does your closed brief cover all of the items on the special appendix and any that you think should be added to it?
No, Mr. Justice, it does not refer to all of them. What I tried to do in my closed brief was I spent all yesterday afternoon in constant successive conversation with the individuals from the State Department, the Defense Department, the National Security Agency, and I said, look, tell me what are the worst. Tell me what are the things that really make trouble. And they told me, and I made longhand notes of what they told me, and from that I prepared the closed brief.
Well, Mr. Solicitor General, if we disagreed with you on those that you have covered, the remainder of the items needn't be looked at?
Mr. Justice, I think that that the odds are strong that that is an accurate statement. I must say that I have not examined every one of the items.
Are you making an argument that even if those 10 that you've covered don't move us very far, nevertheless the cumulative impact of all the others might tip the scale?
And that there ought to be an opportunity for a full and free judicial consideration of each of the items covered in the supplemental appendix. Now, perfectly true that there was a trial before Judge Gazelle in the District Court of the United States. I referred to it in my closed brief as hastily conducted, and have said that there was no trace of criticism in that. Judge Gazelle started the trial at 8 o'clock last Monday morning and was under orders from the Court of Appeals to have his decision made by 5 p.m. And there are 47 volumes of material and millions of words. And there are people in various agencies of the government who have to be consulted. And Mr. Glendon quite appropriately conducted cross-examination, which took time. And much of the material had to be presented by affidavits. And there simply has not been a full, careful consideration of this material. To the best of my knowledge, based on what was told me yesterday afternoon by the concerned persons, the 10 items in my supplement, in my closed brief, are the ones on which we most rely, but I have not seen a great many of the other items in the special appendix, simply for sheer lack of time.
What was the length of the trial before Judge Gerfein in New York?
Mr. Seymour?
The in-camera proceedings, Your Honor, were approximately 4 hours, including cross-examination and argument.
And what was the length of the hearing in the Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit?
The in-camera argument, the total argument there, public and in-camera, was just over 3 hours. The in-camera portion, I would guess, was about an hour.
And decisions were rendered in the New York case by the district court within 2 days afterwards?
Within less than 24 hours after, Your Honor. The hearing finally finished at 10:45 p.m. on Friday night. The decision was rendered 2:25 Saturday afternoon.
And what was the time interval of the decision of the Court of Appeals?
I believe it went one full day, Your Honor. That is, the decision was rendered late in the day of the 23rd. Argument was finished about 5, shortly after 5 on the 27th.
And in the District of Columbia proceedings, of course, you don't know, but perhaps the Solicitor General does.
The trial in the District of Columbia occurred between 8 a.m. and 5 p.m., including the decision last Monday. I participated in the oral argument in the Court of Appeals, and it occupied 2 hours and a half, 2 hours and 45 minutes. Started at about 2:15 and was over, I think, just before 5. That is the entire amount of judicial time which has been devoted to millions of words.
Mr. Solicitor, I don't want to bring in a red herring in this case, or which might be, but do you also say that the 10 items you have talked about fully justify the classification that has been given them and still remains on them?
Mr. Justice, I'm not sure whether this case turns on classification.
I agree. It probably doesn't, but...
No judicial proceeding has been brought under the Freedom of Information Act by either newspaper. There is provision there for starting a proceeding in court in case materials are wrongly determined. No judicial determination has been made that any classification was arbitrary or capricious. There is a complication here which people who live with this become familiar with, which is that any compilation takes the classification of the highest classified item.
Oh, I understand
item.
That, but on those 10 documents, I won't press you anymore. You think it's perhaps needn't be answered in this case and is perhaps irrelevant.
I think it need not be answered, but my position would be that as to those 10 items, it's more than 10 documents, as to those 10 items, that they are properly classified top secret.
Thank you.
One of the items I should make plain is four volumes of the 47 volumes, four related volumes, all dealing with one specific subject, the broaching of which to the entire world at this time would be of extraordinary seriousness to the security of the United States. And as I say, that is covered in my closed brief, and I'm not free to say more about it.
As I understand it, Mr. Solicitor General, and you tell me, please, if I misunderstand it, your case doesn't really depend upon the classification of this material, whether it's classified or how it's classified. In other words, if the New York Times and the Washington Post had this material as a result of the indiscretion or irresponsibility of an Undersecretary of Defense who took it upon himself to declassify all of this material and turn it over to the and give it to the papers, you would still be here.
I would still be here, but would have one string off my
Well, I didn't
boat.
Understand it was a real string.
Well, that's maybe it isn't, but there are those who think it is, and I must be careful not to concede away in this court grounds which some responsible officers of the government think are important, but I do not
understand. Secondly, I understand, and tell me if I'm wrong again, that your case really doesn't depend upon any assertion of property rights, by analogy to the copyright law. You're not. Your case would be the same if the New York Times had acquired this information by sending one of its employees in to steal it, as it would if it had been presented to the New York Times on a silver platter.
Yes, Mr. Justice,
by an agent of the government. Am I
correct? I don't think that literary property is wholly irrelevant here. But my case does not depend upon it.
Your case depends upon the claim, as I understand it, that the disclosure of this information would result in an immediate grave threat to the security of the United States
yes,
of America.
Mr. Justice.
However it was acquired and however it's classified.
Yes, Mr. Justice, but I think that the fact that it was obviously acquired improperly is not irrelevant in the consideration of that question. And I repeat, obviously acquired improperly.
Well, may I ask, Mr. Solicitor General, am I correct that the injunctions so far granted against the Times and the Post haven't stopped other newspapers from publishing materials based on this study or kindred papers?
It is my understanding, Mr. Justice, though I have not had an opportunity to read everything that has been published in other newspapers, it is my understanding that except with respect to the items in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Boston Globe, there has not been published anything else which is not covered by material already published either in these series or elsewhere. It would appear to us that other papers have sought to get into the act and they have assigned their writers to write what you can, but we have not been able to find new disclosures of previously unpublished material in these other articles.
Well, then, are you suggesting that these other newspapers do not, in fact, have either this study or access to this study or parts of it?
Mr. Justice, I do not know. I have no information whatever.
But you're not telling us that they don't?
No. The only information that I have...
There is the possibility that they do have either the study, the same thing... The post
there is a possibility that anybody has it.
No, but if that were the fact, am I wrong? I've always thought that the rule was that equity has to be rather careful not to issue ineffective injunctions, and isn't that a rule to be to be considered in these cases?
No, I appreciate that. I am trying to say that on the basis of the information now known, this is not that situation. I repeat, I have not read these other articles, I am advised by people who have that they do not contain new disclosures, that they are, it's now become fashionable and popular, you're not a good newspaper unless you've got some of this stuff, and that they have put out articles with all kinds of window dressing, probably very well written, but not containing new disclosures. I am not able to testify to that, and I can't point to anything in the record which supports that. Certainly, we are concerned about the problem of the effectiveness of any order which might be issued here.
Well, I gather you do agree that the ordinary equitable principle is not to issue useless injunctions, isn't it?
Not to issue a useless injunction, and it is our position that there is nothing in this record or no one outside the record which would indicate that this injunction would be useless.
Mr. Solicitor General, one detail in that connection. Is there anything in the record or any information anywhere that the possession by the other newspapers is attributable to the New York Times or to the Washington Post?
No, Mr. Justice. We don't know what they have or how they got it. Nor do we. And that is equally true with the New York Times and the Washington Post.
Have either of these newspapers denied it?
Denied that?
That the possession on the part of the other newspapers is not attributable to them.
I don't know. I don't believe that has been an issue in the Washington Post case. And was there anything like that? And Mr. Seymour advises me there was nothing like that in the New York Times case.
Mr. Solicitor General, in terms of equity on an injunction, however, to the extent anything has been published and has already been revealed, the United States is not seeking an injunction against the further publication of that particular item.
No, Mr. Justice, I think that at that point we would agree that it becomes futile. It is a useless.
Well, would that mean, Mr. Solicitor General, that if the government were to prevail here, and at some time some document within the scope of the injunction that the government got was published in some other newspaper, that then either the Times or the Post could run in and get, to that extent, the injunction modified?
Well, I would think so, Mr. Justice.
But that's the only thing that you do, is that it?
I would think so, yes. I may say that it was both stated in both lower courts in New York by Mr. Seymour and here by me that the President last January directed a complete review of classification of all materials. The several secretaries of State, Defense, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff authorized us then to say that they are prepared to appoint immediately a joint task force to conduct an exhaustive declassification study of the 47 volumes, that they will conduct the study on an expedited basis, and will complete it within any reasonable time that the court may choose. They suggest a minimum of 45 days, and upon completion of the study, the government will withdraw its objection to the publication of any documents which it has found no longer relevant to the national security.
Mr. Solicitor General, is the United States pressing separately your request or your cause of action for the return of the materials, wholly aside from an injunction against
it is not involved in this case in this court at this time.
It is not?
No.
No, but is the government pressing it? Is the government trying to get these materials back from the time?
Well, I can certainly say the government would like to get them back.
That wasn't my question. My question is the government attempting
to get them? The government is not at this time seeking an order for their return.
Well, I thought that was part of your lawsuit, part of your request for relief.
I believe it was, but we did not appeal with respect to that, nor is it covered in our petition for certiorari. Is that not right?
That's correct.
Mr. Solicitor General, on this 45-day study, does that depend on how we rule in this case, or is the government going to do it anyhow?
Oh, Mr. Justice, I will urge the government to do it anyhow.
Well,
of course, if this court does not allow any injunction, it will be futile, because the material will be published, and there won't be any particular, it will be entirely post-mortem to say, oh, well, it was all right anyhow.
Well, suppose the court decides the other way, will the study be made?
The study is going to be made. Uh, I will do my best to see that the study is made, and I believe I have the full support of the entire administration with respect to that. I'm sorry, Mr. Justice?
Wouldn't it be important without this case? That the court, that the government has a right to find out what's available to be published?
Yes, Mr. Justice, except that it's a massive operation. There isn't the slightest doubt in my mind that there has been, as long as I can remember, which is quite a while, a massive overclassification of material, and there has been much too slow review to provide declassification, and the government is in the process of taking steps to try to find a way to work that problem out.
But if this court would by chance rule against you, then the government would surely do it, wouldn't it?
If the court should rule against us here, then it seems to me that it becomes moot with respect to these items. They can be published, and whether we classify them or declassify them is an academic question.
Well, the court will have done the job for you. Is that not so?
Yes.
If we declassify them,
the court will, in effect, have declassified the materials.
Well, I don't understand that, Mr. Solicitor General. I had thought the standard that you were operating under here in terms of a prior restraint wasn't necessarily equivalent to the standard that might be operative in a criminal proceeding. And whether or not a newspaper may be enjoined from publishing classified information doesn't necessarily determine some criminal proceeding.
Well, you're certainly right, Mr. Justice. If I may say so in terms of an examination question, I find it exceedingly difficult to think that any jury would convict or that an appellate court would affirm a conviction of a criminal offense for the publication of materials which this court had said could be published. As simply as a practical matter, whether it was a crime or not, why, these are the same materials that were involved in the New York Times case. All we did was publish them. And I find it difficult to think that such a case should be prosecuted or could effectively
be prosecuted.
But the
standard, conceitedly, is not the same.
It's not the same issue, and I repeat, I think it would technically be a crime if the materials remained classified. Now I would like to get on...
Mr. General, just before you do, this brings me back to my original question of a few moments ago as to what the real basic issue in this case is. As I understand it, you're not claiming that you're entitled to an injunction simply or solely because this is classified material.
No.
Nor do I understand it that you're claiming...
Or
that
because
you're,
we own it.
Just let me finish, please. That you're entitled to an injunction because it was stolen from you, that it's your property. You're claiming rather and basically that whether or not it's classified, or however it's classified, and however it was acquired by these newspapers, the disclosure, the public disclosure of this material would pose a grave and immediate danger to the security of the United States of America, period.
Yes, Mr.
Now, isn't that correct?
Yes,
so declassification, vel non, doesn't have much to do with the basic issue, does it?
I agree with you, except that it's part of the setting. If this material had never been classified, I think we would have a considerably greater difficulty in coming in and saying, well, for example, suppose the material had been included in a public speech made by the President of the United States.
Well, then it'd be in the public domain already.
But we come in and say, you can't print this because it will gravely affect the security of the United States. I think we would plainly be out.
Have a very shaky case on the facts, and that's...
Or suppose it had been...
And this, therefore, is a fact case, isn't it? Until we can decide this case, we have to look at the facts, the evidence in this case that's been submitted under...
In large part, yes, Mr. Justice, but I'm still trying to get some help from the background and the setting, which I repeat, it is not irrelevant that... The concatenation of words here is the property of the United States. That this has been classified under executive orders approved by Congress, and that it obviously has been improperly acquired.
Well, that may have a great deal to do as to whether, on the question of whether or not somebody's guilty of a criminal offense. But I submit it has very little to do with the basic First Amendment issue before this court in this case.
All right, Mr. Justice, I repeat, unless we can show that this will have grave, and I think I would like to amend it. I know the court's order has said immediate, but I think it really ought to be irreparable harm to the security of the United States.
I would think, with all due respect to my colleague, that the question of classification would have an important bearing on the question of the scope of judicial review of an executive classification.
Well, I think, Mr. Justice, that is true. But I also think the heart of our case is that the publication of the material specified in my closed brief will, as I have tried to argue materially affect the security of the United States. It will affect lives. It will affect the process of the termination of the war. It will affect the process of recovering prisoners of war. I cannot say that the termination of the war or recovering prisoners of war is something which has an immediate effect on the security of the United States. I say that it has such an effect on the security of the United States that it ought to be the basis of an injunction in this case. Now, I would like to get to the question of the standard which was used by the district judge in this case. I think it is relevant to point out that on page 267 of the closed of the transcript in the district court before Judge Gazelle, he said, "The court further finds that publication of the documents in the large may interfere with the ability of the Department of State in the conduct of delicate negotiations now in process," not in the past, "now in process, or contemplated for the future, whether these negotiations involve Southeast Asia or other areas of the world. This is not so much because of anything in the documents themselves, but rather results from the fact that it will appear to foreign governments that this government is unable to prevent publication of actual government communications when a leak such as the present one occurs." Now, thus, the judge rejected as a standard in this matter the whole question of the ability of the Department of State, and that means the President, to whom the foreign relations are conferred by the Constitution, to conduct delicate negotiations now in process or contemplated for the future. And I suggest to the court that it is perfectly obvious that the conduct of delicate negotiations now in process or contemplated for the future has an impact on the security of the United States. Now, the standard which the judge did apply is one which, with the benefit of with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, I would have written differently. Executive Order 10501 provides the basis for security classification issued by President Eisenhower in 1953 after a comprehensive study by a commission on these matters. And the definition of top secret in Section 1A of Executive Order 10501 is top secret shall be authorized by appropriate authority only for defense information or material which requires the highest degree of protection. The top secret classification shall be applied only to that information or material that the defense aspect of which is paramount, and the unauthorized disclosure of which could result in exceptionally grave damage to the nation, such as, now this was not intended to be all-inclusive, it is illustrative, such as leading to a definite break in diplomatic relations affecting the defense of the United States, an armed attack against the United States or its allies, a war, or the compromise of military or defense plans or intelligence operations, or scientific or technological developments vital to the national defense. And what Judge Gazelle has used that as the standard. He made no reference whatever to the succeeding classification, which is secret, and there is also a classification which is confidential. But Judge Gazelle has used as the basis of his decision, and I suggest this was fundamental error, that there is no proof, this is on page 269 of the transcript of the hearing before Judge Gazelle, there is no proof that there will be a definite break in diplomatic relations, that there will be an armed attack on the United States, that there will be an armed attack on an ally, that there will be a war, that there will be a compromise of military or defense plans, and in my closed brief, I contend that he was wrong on that, a compromise of intelligence operations, and in my closed brief, I contend that he was plainly wrong on that, or a compromise of scientific and technological materials. And if the standard is that we cannot prevent the publication of improperly acquired material unless we can show in substance and effect, because that's what he really meant, that there will be a break in diplomatic relations or that there will be an armed attack on the United States, I suggest that the standard which Judge Gazelle used is far too narrow. Now, perhaps it lies in between. My own thought would be in the present perilous state of the world, considering negotiations in the Middle East, considering the SALT talks now going on, and it's not inappropriate to remember that SALT is strategic arms limitation talks, the consequences of which obviously have, in all likelihood, not the prevention of a nuclear attack tomorrow, maybe not next week, but only by success in this kind of negotiations can we have any hope that our children and our children's children will have a world to live in. I suggest that when it is found by the district court that the publication of the documents in the large may interfere with the ability of the Department of State in the conduct of delicate negotiations now in process or contemplated for the future, that should be enough by itself to warrant the restraint on the publication of the now quite narrowly selected group of materials covered in the special appendix and dealt with in some detail in my closed brief and the related papers which have been filed with the court this morning.
Could I ask you a question before you sit down? I had understood from your papers and the brief that you filed this morning that the only specific relief at this stage, at this juncture, the proceeding you're asking for is a Court of Appeals decision, and the Times case should be affirmed, namely, that the further hearings before the district court and reported by the Court of Appeals should go forward to a conclusion. And as regards the Washington Post case, that you were asking only that the proceedings there be conformed to the proceedings in the Court of Appeals in the Second Circuit. And that therefore the broader questions that you've been talking about are not before the court at the moment.
No, Mr. Justice, I think I can't agree with that. It is our position that Judge Gazelle used the wrong standard, as I have just said. And it is our view that the judgment of the Second Circuit should be affirmed and the case remanded to Judge Gerfein for further hearing under a proper standard, which I hope this court will develop and announce, and that the decision of the Court of Appeals be reversed and the case remanded to Judge Gazelle for further hearing in the application of the proper standard which this court has decided. Because it is our view, as I have endeavored to contend, that in rational terms in the modern world, the standard that Judge Gazelle applied is just too narrow. That, and as I've said, that the standard should be great and irreparable harm to the security of the United States. In the whole diplomatic area, the things don't happen at 8:15 tomorrow morning. It may be weeks or months. People tell me that already channels of communication on which a great hope had been placed have dried up. I haven't the slightest doubt myself that the material which has already been published and the publication of the other materials affects American lives and is a thoroughly serious matter. And I think that to say that it can only be enjoined if there will be a war tomorrow morning, when there's a war now going on, is much too narrow.
Thank you, Mr. Solicitor General.